Good morning. I'm Eugene Meyer, president of the Federalist Society, and in addition to welcoming all of you, I want to welcome our C-SPAN audience this morning. To most of you, this won't be a surprise, but I have a good report from from last night. As you know, we're very honored to have Attorney General Mukasey addressing our banquet. As you also know, very unfortunately, he collapsed toward the end of his speech. He had a good night in the hospital. Everything looks very good. He's expected to be discharged today. So I wanted to let you all know that. Having done that, I want to call on Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, who's been a longtime friend of the Federalist Society and longtime judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit to moderate this panel. Judge Wilkinson.
Good morning. Delighted to be here. We've got a very serious topic to cover today, and that is whether Supreme Court justices should continue to enjoy life tenure or whether they should be subject to staggered and non-renewable 18-year terms. I hope nobody broaches the subject of abrogating life tenure for Court of Appeals judges, but if they do, that's fair game too. But it's a serious topic. We're going to have a lot of fun with it because we've got a great group of panelists here. Congratulate the Federalist Society in assembling some of the people that have given them the very most thought, the best thought to this topic. It's a pleasure for me to introduce as our leadoff speaker Chuck Cooper, who is a founding partner of Cooper and Kirk, and he's certainly one of the premier Washington attorneys of his generation. You don't have to just take my word for it. The National Law Journal named him as one of the 10 best civil litigators in the Capitol. Chuck and I first met shortly after his clerkship with Chief Justice Rehnquist, and we served together in President Reagan's Justice Department in the Civil Rights Division. And the issues there were challenging and volatile, and it was there that I became very impressed with Chuck's legal acumen and his marvelous way with dealing with people. And Chuck and I became fast friends, and we've just been that way ever since. Chuck went on from the Civil Rights Division to great things. He served under President Reagan as Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel. And he's a nationally renowned litigant and a principal conservative who has the gift of appreciating and respecting worthy adversaries with which he might not always agree. And whatever topic Chuck addressed, he will do so in a very thoughtful and stimulating fashion. And Chuck, it's just great to have you here, and thanks for leading off our panel.
Well, thank you very much, Judge Wilkinson. It's an honor, as always, to be reunited with you here on this panel and to join such a distinguished group of scholars. The title of this panel presents us with a choice, but I don't favor either alternative. Life tenure was designed to free the Supreme Court from the coercive influence of the federal government's more powerful political branches, and it did. But it also freed the justices to become tyrants. In the recent times, some of them have. These modern judicial tyrants have, notwithstanding Hamilton's assurances in number 78, exercised will instead of judgment. And they have now even come to claim that it is their right and responsibility under the Constitution to do so. Fixed non-renewable terms are addressed primarily to concerns stemming from the fact that modern justices are living longer, and they're serving far longer than the average 15-year tenures that prevailed before 1970. But the real problem of life tenure isn't old or even infirm justices. It's willful activist justices. And while any limit on the tenure of a bad judge would be an improvement, a fixed non-renewable term would throw out good with the bad, cutting short the tenures of the Rehnquists as well as the Brennans. The basis on which the whole American fabric was erected is that the Constitution embodies the supreme will of the people and is accordingly a superior paramount law, unchangeable by ordinary means. Therefore, a legislative act contrary to the Constitution is not law. And to ensure that this paramount and permanent law may not be mistaken or forgotten, the Constitution is written, and it establishes a rule for the government of courts as well as of the legislature. Now, these words from Marbury against Madison efficiently capture the constitutional rule of law that lies at the heart not only of the doctrine of judicial review, but of our constitutional order. Chief Justice Marshall was echoing Hamilton's observation in number 78 that the Constitution embodies the intention of the people and therefore must be regarded by the judges as a fundamental law, binding until the people have, by some solemn and authoritative act, annulled it or changed it. The framers understood that enforcing the rule of law would not be easy. The judiciary would, as Hamilton put it, be in continual jeopardy of being overpowered, awed, or influenced by its coordinated branches. And it will require an uncommon portion of fortitude in the judges to do their duty as faithful guardians of the Constitution. And so life tenure was designed to supply the complete independence, as they put it, thought necessary to enable the judges to faithfully and firmly enforce the will of the people over the contrary will of legislative majorities. The problem is that the judiciary's complete independence also enabled the judges to impose the will of the judges over the contrary will of legislative majorities. The framers were well aware of that danger. Indeed, Brutus, writing in the Anti-Federalist, warned in a famous passage that life-tenured judiciary would be independent not only of the legislature, but of the people too, and in due time, even of heaven itself. The independence would enable the judges to interpret the Constitution, as he put it, according to the reasoning spirit of it, without being confined to the word or letter. And if the power of construing the Constitution is lodged in the hands of men independent of the people and of their representatives, and who are not constitutionally accountable for their opinions, no way is left to control them but with a high hand and an outstretched arm. Hamilton answered that while particular misconstructions may now and then happen, judicial willfulness need not be feared, for Congress's impeachment power would provide a complete security against a series of deliberate usurpations. Well, the threat of impeachment turned out to be no check at all, and everything that Brutus predicted has, and more, come to pass now. Deliberate judicial usurpations of legislative power occur annually, with each Supreme Court term adding new cases to the Bill of Particulars. But what Brutus and the Anti-Federalists did not foresee was that some unchecked, unaccountable justices not only would exercise legislative power under cover of constitutional interpretation, but would openly claim that doing so is within the legitimate constitutional authority of their judicial office. The original meaning of the words and phrases of the written Constitution are not, according to these judges, binding on courts, but rather must give way to the judges' own notions of evolving standards of decency, or the ideal of human dignity, or some similar slogan, licensing the judge to impose his will. Now, this is a relatively recent phenomenon. It began, I think, with Chief Justice Earl Warren. He coined the marvelously liberating phrase, evolving standards of decency. It was unknown of the U.S. reports before his time. Warren would often interrupt oral argument with the impatient query, "Yes, yes, counsel, but is it right? Is it good?" And there's simply no doubt that this was the sole standard that guided his constitutional decisions. Did Chief Justice Warren write a single opinion, or even cast a single vote, that one might have reason to suspect was contrary to the way he would have cast it as a legislator? Now, the same question could be asked of Justice William Brennan, who in a famous 1985 speech ridiculed the search for the Constitution's original meaning as little more than arrogance cloaked in humility. "It is arrogant to pretend," said Brennan, "that from our vantage we can gauge accurately the intent of the framers on application of principle to specific contemporary questions." He continued, "The ultimate question must be, what do the words of the text mean in our time? What the constitutional fundamentals meant to the wisdom of other times cannot be their measure to the vision of our time." And in our time, the meaning of the constitutional fundamentals is measured, according to Brennan, by a sparkling vision of the supremacy of the human dignity of every individual, a vision which can be discerned only through, in his words, a personal confrontation with the wellsprings of our society. Well, it was in obedience to that sparkling vision and in open defiance of the plain text of the Constitution that Justice Brennan often opined that capital punishment is under all circumstances prohibited by the Eighth Amendment. The situation has not improved much since then. In Lawrence against Texas, the activists on the court finally got the fifth vote to formally announce that the moral values of the people would no longer constitute a legitimate state interest on which to base social legislation. And this is what they said. "The fact that the governing majority in a state has traditionally viewed a particular practice as immoral is not a sufficient reason for upholding a law prohibiting the practice. The moral values of the justices, you see, are what matter." This truth was brought into sharp focus and searing focus just last term when five justices ruled that evolving standards of decency required them to outlaw the death penalty for the crime of child rape. The majority's decision ultimately turned on its own independent judgment. I repeat, its own independent judgment. That justice, in its words, that justice would be better served by confining the rapist and thus preserving the possibility that he and the system will find ways to allow him to understand the enormity of his offense. So the question of where justice lies, where morality lies on this issue, was not for the people of Louisiana. The justices will tell them where it lies. And nor is this predicament likely to get any better for quite a while, given what President-elect Obama has said he will be looking for in the judges that he appoints. And he has cited Earl Warren as his model judge. Ladies and gentlemen, we have come to a time in which the Supreme Court justices, life-tenured and wholly unaccountable, have openly disavowed the constitutional rule of law in favor of the rule of the justices. And the people have, in Lincoln's words, thus ceased to be their own rulers, having to that extent practically resigned their government into the hands of that eminent tribunal. What manner of freedom-loving, self-respecting, sovereign, democratic people would abide that? Reform is not going to come from the justices themselves. Some measure of accountability must be imposed on them. Life tenure has to go. Thank you.
Chuck, thank you so much, and you were up to your usual standards of candor. It was a pleasure to have you here. Our next panelist is Jim Lindgren, who's the Benjamin Mazur Research Professor at Northwestern University School of Law. Jim has authored many distinguished writings, and he's held a number of important academic posts. But for today's purposes, he, along with Steve Calabresi, are authors of a very influential article, Term Limits for the Supreme Court, Life Tenure Reconsidered. And there's been a lot of excellent writing on this entire subject. But if you're looking for reasons why this whole topic has become such a hot one, you need to read Jim and Steve's article. And anyone who enters this debate simply has to be prepared to deal with the arguments that they make. I can't resist injecting a personal note at this point. Jeff Oldham from Northwestern University was one of my very finest law clerks. And he graduated from Northwestern in 2003 and is thanked in the article for very substantial contributions that he made to it. And when Jeff came on board as my law clerk, I asked him what it was like to work with two such academic luminaries. And he said, "Hey, those guys are really smart. No kidding." And Jim, we're so delighted to have you today, and thank you for the thought that you and Steve have devoted to this topic.
Okay, let's have some fun with numbers here. So there are limitations on Supreme Court tenure. Let's see if this button will work. The proposal that we have, and we have very short time, so this will be a bit of a forced march, is we're talking about a constitutional amendment, not a statute, 18-year terms. We choose a new justice every odd year, so 2009 in the summer, 2011, 2013, and so on. After sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court for 18 years, you'd still have life tenure, but not on the Supreme Court. You could sit on lower courts if you wished. I'm going to get the button to work here. Where should I be pointing it here? Okay. There's a phase-in period, which in questions I'm happy to talk about. If this had been enforced, just to think, if this had been enforced from the beginning of time, we'd have four Clinton appointees now, four Bush 43 appointees, and one Bush 41 appointee who'd be leaving in this summer. So Justice Scalia would be long gone, and Justice Thomas would be soon stepping down, and we would have a different profile. The length of tenure, this shows length of tenure on the court over time, and it shows every nine justices. It's a lagging average of nine justices together, so it's not in any particular period of time. And it shows some peaks early on in the 1830s and 40s and in the 1860s and 70s. And in the 1830s or 40s, they added two more justices to come up to nine. In the 1860s and 70s, they fixed permanently at nine justices and added pensions. And so each time that there was a peak, they dealt with the problem by reform. The age at leaving office, as you can see, there was a peak in the 1880s and then another one in the 1930s and 40s, in the period that's usually pejoratively called the nine old men in the 30s. And now we're at 79 years as the age at leaving office. Of course, that's the average age. That's not the the high age. That's the average. The mean years from the last court vacancy, we're up over 3.3 on the last one, and the one before was 3.8 years between vacancies. And once they instituted pensions, the numbers stayed below around 1.8, 1.9 in that range for many, many decades, for over 100 years. Now, this isn't an issue of being sworn in at earlier ages. As you can see, if you look at the age of swearing in, except for the first period, it's been pretty much flat This is not an issue involved with appointing younger justices, something that we found when we looked at the data. Now, some of the arguments that are made, and my contribution to the piece is primarily on the statistical side, and Steve's is on the policy side. Only one state, Rhode Island, has life tenure. Steve and his research assistants, including Jeff Oldham, did not find any other major Western democracy that has life tenure for its main constitutional court. There's a problem of mental decrepitude, which you can read about in some of the histories of the court. There's a loss of physical stamina. We had Justice Rehnquist, who was losing some of his ability to function in his last year, and we've had Justice Ginsburg, who's fallen asleep on the bench this year and in other years while court is meeting. One of the things that it would do is eliminate strategic retirement for political motives, and I'll talk about that in a minute. It should reduce animosity and confirmation, although the two people opposing this, I'm sure, will disagree vigorously on this. If it becomes a regular function, then the stakes are lower. It's not like you're appointing someone for 35 years. It's for 18 years, and it should lower the intensity of the fights over this. And we would return to traditional levels of judicial independence. As justices serve longer on the court, they tend to get farther and farther away from public opinion. And every time in the past when tenures got very long, we did something about it. In the 1830s, we added two justices. In 1870, pensions were started. And in 1937, we added senior status, all of which dealt with the problem previously. There's long been asserted that justices time their retirement politically, strategically. I have a new article that just came out in Demography, the leading demography journal, with Rafe Stolzenberg, a methodologist at Chicago, on politicized departure. And the timing of resignations from the U.S. Supreme Court tend to be influenced by political as well as personal characteristics. Obviously, there are personal characteristics that are relevant, like pension and age and health and so forth. This chart shows the trend smooth with LOES, which is Cleveland's locally weighted regression. And what this shows, the bottom line, the black line shows the age at appointment. The middle line shows the age currently. The purple line shows the age at retirement. And the green line shows age at death. And as you can see, they're getting wider between the black line, which is the age at retirement, and the age at death. This particular one is not only smooth, but this looks at the current year on a court. So it basically says in a particular year, when will those justices who are sitting that year die, retire, and so forth. So it's a slightly different analysis, but it looks more at a midpoint rather than at the end. So justice leaving the court from 1789 to 1970, the average tenure was 14.9 years. Age at leaving office was 68 years, and the years between vacancies was 2 years. Now they're leaving the court at average tenure is 26 years of those who've left the court since 1970. Age at leaving office is 79 years, and the years between vacancies is more than 3 years. This is kind of a neat chart. This shows... So let's say you serve a year on the court, and then you serve another year and another year. At each year you serve, does it make you more or less likely to retire? Political scientists who've looked at this typically assume that the longer you serve on the court, the more likely you are to retire. But it turns out that you're less likely to retire the longer you serve on the court, and the effective additional year is most at age 15. 15 years on the court. Only at 25 years on the court do you become more likely to retire for each year that you serve on the court. These just slides just explain that. Okay. Now, pension eligibility. Not surprisingly, judges are rational justices. They when they're eligible for a pension, they're 8 times more likely to odds are 8 times higher that they'll retire in a year in which they're pension eligible than in years in which they're not. The odds of retirement increase by 168% when the sitting president is from the same political party as the president who nominated the justice, and you're in the first or second year of a presidential administration. So there's a very big political effect on strategic retirement. We also found that there was effect on dying in office. So this is failed strategic retirement. The odds of death in office in any given year are significantly decreased when the sitting president of the same party as the president who first nominated the justice of the court. The odds of death in office are only two-thirds as high, and if you're in the last 2 years, then your odds are only one-third as high. So this is the, you know, if the opposing party of the opposing president's in office, basically, you know, if you want this robe, you're going to have to pry it from my cold, dead hands. And that's the essential idea there. Okay, just to review, we see the trends are increasing over time. The we see big jumps in length of tenure from 15 years to 26 years. There's issues of stamina, decrepitude. It's unusual to have life tenure in other societies. We've got strategic retirement. And we should return to traditional levels of judicial independence. I would say that one argument that I think that has been made against it, I do find meritorious, and that is I think it would increase strategic behavior by justices in choosing cases. Right now there's a little bit of it when they expect someone might leave or might join the court, but I think if they knew exactly when someone would be leaving, I think they could take it into account in choosing which cases to hear. I'm sure we'll hear many other plausible and implausible arguments against it, but I just wanted to grant that I think that one actually does have some merit. Let's see. I guess the only last point I'd make is that every time in the past when we've had very long tenures, long times between tenures, we've done something about it. I don't think we should be ostriches today. We should try to take some action on that in this area to ameliorate current problems as we have in the past. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jim. We appreciate that so much. And it's now time to turn to the other side of the argument. David Strauss is a professor of law at the University of Minnesota, and he's presently visiting at Washington University in St. Louis. In his short time in academia, David has become very much a rising star. And he's received a number of teaching awards, and he's gaining distinction for not only thoughtful articles, but for public commentary on the federal courts. And his excellent article on retaining life tenure, The Case for a Golden Parachute, not only makes a powerful case for the continuation of life tenure, but also proposes incentives to encourage voluntary retirement at an appropriate time. I also want to inject a note of personal appreciation and pleasure at having David here. He is a Fourth Circuit alumnus, and he clerked for my good colleague, Judge Mike Luttig, and among the many fine things that Judge Luttig did when he was on our court was to choose a really stellar clerks and launch them into distinguished professional careers. And David is just a shining example of that. And David, we warmly welcome you to this panel.
Well, I'd like to first thank Judge Wilkinson for that very generous introduction, and to the Federalist Society for inviting me to come speak to you all about something that I've spent a little bit of time thinking about. I come with the enviable position of defending the Constitution today, because the Constitution, after all, sets forth that judges shall serve during good behavior. Good behavior, and this is in the retaining life tenure article, means for life, essentially for life. That was the understanding when the Constitution was adopted. Now, what I want to do is say, I certainly cannot address all of Jim's arguments, very, very well-reasoned arguments, but I want to address at least and put forward an affirmative case for life tenure, because after all, the framers must have been thinking about something when they decided upon life tenure, and I would submit that it was a very careful process, and they deliberated about it quite a bit before they made their final decision. So one important aspect of life tenure is, I would could argue it for a Burkean conservative in particular, it decelerates legal change. Jim and Chuck, I think, both talked about the lack of democratic accountability, that as justices grow older, they serve on the court for a lengthier period of time, sometimes 30, sometimes 35 years, they become out of touch with public opinion. Well, one of the effects, though, of having justices serve for a longer period of time is that we don't see rapid fluctuations of the law back and forth. We see a relatively stable judiciary. Many political scientists and legal scholars have noted that once a judge takes a position on a particular issue, it is very rare when they reverse course on that position. So I think it very much encourages judges to adhere to positions and thus create a very stable framework for judicial decision making. The other issue in terms of slow legal change is the issue of court capture. Under an 18-year non-renewable term plan, which Calabresi and Lindgren have put forward, it would allow a president essentially to capture the court during a two-term presidency. I mean, granted, they would only get four appointments, but with the balance of the court often swinging on a single vote, it is very easy to imagine a scenario in which a single president serving two terms would be able to capture the court. And certainly in a presidency like FDR's or during three straight Republican presidencies, it's not that unusual to think that the court would be radically changed by those appointments. So for somebody who's Burkean and really needs a good reason to change the Constitution, I'm left a bit unsatisfied by the argument that's advanced in Calabresi and Lindgren's article. The second really important aspect of life tenure is judicial independence. The Constitution sets forth essentially two pillars of judicial independence, the first being non-diminishment of salary, which really over the course of history hasn't been all that important. There haven't been very many congressional efforts to diminish salary. But the other is life tenure. That is a key pillar of judicial independence. And Jim alluded to this. I find very persuasive. He said it was meritorious. I find very persuasive the final period problem that we have with justices. Unlike now, under 18-year non-renewable terms, justices would know with absolute certainty when their colleagues would retire. They know when they would retire. So one can imagine a justice 2 years before they're retiring saying, goodness, I need to solidify my legacy. The political opportunity has never been greater for us to advance a particular doctrine or to overrule a particular doctrine. Thus, I'm going to reach out and take a case that the court otherwise wouldn't have taken. They may ignore justiciability concerns. They may ignore jurisdictional concerns. And so I think it really sets a precedent in disrupting judicial independence. And it's not only the fact that they know that they would retire, but they know when everyone else would retire. So if they see that the political winds are changing and 4 years from now, say it's a Republican-controlled court and the Democrats look like they're going to win, then there's going to be every incentive for a Republican-dominated court to take as many of the cases they think they can win on the front end. So it really results in a lot of game playing. The other issue is 18-year non-renewable terms, unlike mandatory retirement ages, which is the other sort of proposal that's been advanced in the academy, really does present other issues of judicial independence. For example, a justice who retires at, say, age 61 or 62 under the non-renewable term limits may try to gain or curry favor with the political branches towards the end of their term. Justice Thomas, my old boss, although I don't think he would ever do this, but somebody like him who was appointed at the young age of 43, I could see making an attempt to become ambassador to the United Nations or whatever upon his forced retirement for the court. And I just highly doubt that justices would find satisfying the prospect of sitting on the lower courts, because after all, once they retire from the court, they get to sit on the lower courts. So, you know, it just doesn't seem to me to be a real persuasive argument. If we could throw up the PowerPoint real quick, that would be great. I'm going to first show you the chart that Calabresi and Lindgren came up with. I call it the Calabresi and Lindgren chart because it's been relied upon so heavily by so many scholars. It shows a final period average tenure of 26.1 years. When you look at that chart, it's extremely striking. It looks like there's been a fundamental change in life tenure. And again, I do want to compliment Steve Calabresi and Jim Lindgren on putting forth a very forceful case on life tenure. Can we go to the next slide? But there's another chart that I looked at. They look at it by date of retirement. If you look at it by date of swearing in, you don't see the great advances in average tenure. In fact, the final period is around 19.6 years, which is lower than the period from 1811 to 1840. Now, one may ask, well, why would you choose swearing-in date? There's a couple of reasons. One is to the extent that the proponents of life tenure are relying on democratic accountability, that's on the front end when they're considering nominees, that's exactly when the democratic accountability happens. And so, you know, those things like the age of the justices, how long they might serve, those are things that are taken into account by the Senate when they're considering nominees. The other issue is you could take the midpoint, you could take the three-quarters point and graph it anywhere along there, and you won't see nearly the robustness of that final period that the Calabresi and Lindgren chart shows. And a truly robust trend would show up no matter how you measure it, whether it's ex ante or ex post. I don't want to get too far into the numbers, and we can actually take the PowerPoint away. But I do want to say, you know, also think practically. So the only justice who would retire in the next 4 years that would lengthen the 26.1 years in the Calabresi and Lindgren chart is Stevens. Scalia would come pretty close, but Stevens is really the only one that would lengthen the chart in terms of average tenure. But you look at all the justices who might retire over the course of the next several years. Ginsburg, Souter have been all speculated about. All of those would reduce average tenure. So the only sitting justice that would lengthen average tenure during an Obama presidency is in fact Stevens. So I agree ultimately that term lengths are getting longer on the Supreme Court. But I would make another very fundamental originalist argument, and that is the framers knew exactly what they were getting themselves into. You look at the anti-federalist and the federalist papers. Federal Farmer number 15, for example, it complains the most, you know, really Federal Farmer is one of the most famous anti-federalist papers. In that, they complained that the life tenure judges would serve, quote, 30 or 40 years. They knew what they were getting themselves into. Federalist number 79, criticized New York's mandatory retirement age. They considered a mandatory retirement age because New York had it, and they rejected it. They rejected it outright because they thought that, quote, the deliberating and comparing faculties generally preserve their strength much beyond that period in men who survive it. So the framers carefully thought about that. And so ultimately, you know, I agree with some, I particularly agree with the Calabresi and Lindgren argument about mental infirmity. It's been there the whole existence of the court. One justice in particular, Justice Baldwin, suffered from the 1830s, suffered incurable lunacy. He used to run up and down the corridors in his stocking feet while the justices were deliberating and literally did not decide a case for several years. There's other examples. Justice Douglas, his colleagues voted 7-1 to keep him from writing opinions and to hold over cases where he was the deciding vote. So there is a long history of mental infirmity on the court. Now the question is, what do we do about that? I think that the case has not been made to change life tenure. At bottom, I'm a fundamental Burkean conservative who believes that everything in the Constitution has very strong meaning and very strong reasons behind it. And so I would favor something more incremental, making it more attractive for justices when they retire to do things that complement or mirror what they do now, or better yet, change the pension reform system. And so those are some of my thoughts, and I will certainly be excited to hear your questions during the question and answer period. Thank you.
Our final panelist is Professor Stephen Burbank of the University of Pennsylvania, and he is by any measure one of our country's foremost proceduralists. His expertise is internationally sought, and I don't think it would surprise you that the Third Circuit has turned to him to help tackle some of its challenging procedural problems, and it may not surprise you that the Congress has turned to him for testimony on numerous occasions. But what might interest you is that the National Football League has turned to Steve, and both the management and players have asked him to help mediate and resolve certain categories of disputes under the collective bargaining agreement. I think that while he's distinguished in so many areas, Professor Burbank has gained a reputation for his candor and insight on questions involving judicial independence. And Suffice it to say that he's brought a vigorous skepticism to the proposition that life tenure is responsible for all the ills ascribed to the judicial system, and a skepticism to the notion that changing life tenure is some kind of magic bullet lurking in the background. So, Steve, thank you so much for your contributions to this area, and it's a great pleasure to have you with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Judge. I've long been interested in questions of judicial administration, particularly those that implicate judicial independence and accountability. In the 1990s, I realized that there was a rich political science literature that could and should inform considerations of such questions, and I began to read in that literature and reflect its fruits in my scholarship. In 2001, my friend and colleague Barry Friedman of NYU and I became persuaded that scholars in different disciplines who were writing about judicial behavior were like ships passing in the night. We therefore organized a conference at Penn Law that brought together scholars from law, political science, history, and economics to discuss judicial independence. That conference led to our book, Judicial Independence at the Crossroads, an Interdisciplinary Approach. Thus, the questions I had about proposals to replace life tenure for justices with non-renewable 18-year terms, when the authors of one of those proposals first asked me to support it, were largely the sorts of empirical and strategic questions to which study of political science had exposed me. I was concerned that most proponents of change relied on unsupported normative arguments about the supposed costs of the current system and that they ignored potential costs of the alternatives they promoted. As my article, which is on the website, I understand, reflects, research persuaded me that those concerns are justified. From my perspective, an overarching weakness of the work of those advocating change is the failure to take seriously the importance of bringing empirical work to the consideration of questions of public policy, coupled with what I call, perhaps uncharitably, historical tone deafness. To be sure, Calabresi and Lindgren marshal and manipulate a lot of data about the justices, but their use of those data, in my view, is wooden, lacking in historical perspective, and because they do not seem interested in existing studies bearing directly on the questions they consider, tendentious. For example, they ignore both logic and evidence in arguing that life tenure, as currently practiced, provides an unacceptable incentive for presidents to appoint very young justices. The evidence indicates to the contrary that this is an incentive of life tenure itself, that it was more compelling when life expectancies were short, and that whether a president yields to it depends upon his agenda in making appointments, as it may be constrained by the Senate. The same is true of the claim that the current system of life tenure is responsible for increased contentiousness of the appointment process for justices, a claim that sometimes sweeps within it the appointment of lower federal court judges as well. Again, the evidence strongly suggests that the cause is not lengthening tenure, but rather the appointment agenda of the president and the reaction thereto on the part of the Senate. With respect to justices overstaying the time when they are up to the work of the court, so-called mental decrepitude, proponents of change fail to acknowledge that this was a much more serious problem in the 19th century, before the advent of adequate retirement arrangements, and that recent manifestations have been of relatively short duration. The phenomenon of strategic partisan retirement behavior, another supposed cost of the current system, has been studied by a number of political scientists. Almost all of those studies find that it has not been a significant problem, if only because justices do not control the larger political environment in which their retirement decisions must be made, and the desire of some of them to time their retirement strategically has yielded to personal considerations, chiefly those of health. Another overarching weakness of many proposals for change, or so it seems to me, is that they are predicated on a theory of democratic accountability that is seriously impoverished. One problem is that proponents of change assume or assert that the appointment process is the only means by which federal judges can be held accountable, which a consideration of history demonstrates to be demonstrably false as to formal powers potentially constraining judicial behavior, and which ignores perhaps the most important current research on courts and political science, work that takes account of the strategic incentives to moderate the single-minded pursuit of preferences. Indeed, a forthcoming article by a prominent political scientist, Jeffrey Siegel, who has previously denied that Congress constrains the Supreme Court's constitutional decision-making, finds, to his chagrin as an attitudinalist, but to his credit as a scholar, robust evidence that indeed the justices pay attention to Congress, curbing their sincere preferences in the interest of what Siegel calls institutional maintenance. A more fundamental problem is that proponents of change take a view of judicial independence and judicial accountability that is both dichotomous and monolithic. Recent interdisciplinary work reveals that, to the contrary, judicial independence and accountability are different sides of the same coin, and that there is no one right mix. Thus, it is no comfort that, viewed solely from the perspective of judicial independence, non-renewable 18-year terms would seem to augur adequate independence. We need to know what they portend in terms of judicial accountability, and whether the resulting mix is well suited to yield what we want from the Supreme Court today. Data on high courts of other countries or of the states of the United States, and by the way, judges are elected in most of the states, and I don't understand that any proposal calls, actually there is one, calls for electing the justices of the Supreme Court, in fact tell us very little unless we know what those polities seek from their courts and whether the mix their systems yield would be appropriate for the Supreme Court of the United States in 2008. Proponents of change also promote non-renewable 18-year terms on the ground that the court is insufficiently legitimate. Now, this is a very slippery term, both in law and political science, but a great deal of theoretical and empirical work has been done in the latter field that seeks to bring it to ground. That work, which distinguishes between specific support, that is, support for individual decisions, and diffuse support, that is, support for the institution as a whole, tells us that the public knows precious little about the work of the court, that most of what they know comes from the mass media, and that it is only controversial or high salience cases that are likely to register. Moreover, studies of public support for the Supreme Court in the wake of Bush against Gore simply do not support the notion that there is currently a crisis of legitimacy. The court continues to enjoy a fairly deep reservoir of diffuse support, and it fares better in terms of both diffuse and specific support than does the President or Congress. Of course, these findings also call in question the argument that the appointment process is a suitable means to translate public values to the court. Finally, in my article, I consider the other side of the coin, largely ignored by proponents of change. What is the quantum and quality of judicial accountability likely to flow from a system in which, when fully operational, each four-year presidency would see two appointments to the court? In order to answer that question, I explore the political science literature on interest groups, which have become prominent players in the federal judicial appointment process, which are here to stay, and the incentives and tactics of which do not bode well for the claim that non-renewable 18-year terms will yield a less contentious process. Indeed, when one considers the insights of the interest group literature with those of the legitimacy literature exploring what the public knows about the court and how it knows it, a most disturbing prospect emerges. For, at least to the extent that the messages that interest groups and their patrons send to the public concern decisional results, for example, what will this appointment do to Roe against Wade, a system of frequent and predictable appointments seems likely to hasten a crisis of legitimacy, one that would cement the worst tendencies of modern politics. The public would be encouraged to regard courts not just as part of the political system, but as part of ordinary politics. If this were to occur, and there are already worrisome tendencies in that direction because some politicians, interest groups, and journalists have chosen to portray judges as the policy agents of those who appoint or elect them, either judicial independence would become the junior partner of judicial accountability, or the partnership would be dissolved. I used to be somewhat defensive about Richard Posner's characterization of traditional legal scholarship as epistemically shallow, although I always hoped that my own attention to history and to empiricism preserved me from his indictment. Posner was right, but this work on term limits for the Supreme Court persuades me that the object of his criticism today should be not just and not primarily traditional doctrinal scholarship, but the normative navel-gazing that continues to preoccupy so many in the legal academy, particularly those who write about constitutional law. Thank you.
To pose several questions to each group of panelists, and Chuck and Jim, it seems to me that the most serious of the arguments against your position is that your proposal is really going to increase strategic behavior on the part of the justices at the Supreme Court, that they're going to look down the road, they're going to be granting cases that they ordinarily wouldn't grant, they're going to be trying to reach results before somebody favorable to their side steps down, that they're going to be somebody who knows they're going to have to retire in 2 years is going to be slamming dicta into an opinion in order to get it done before he or she has to step down, and that justices are going to be thinking about second careers. In other words, a fairly serious argument has been leveled against your position, which is that you're really increasing political and strategic behavior on the part of the Supreme Court with your proposal. And I think you have to meet that. So what's your response?
Well, as I said in the presentation, part of what you said I would absolutely grant. I think that that in terms of choosing cases, I think that there's likely to be some strategic behavior. But the strategic behavior that's eliminated in terms of retirement, I think would be quite substantial. And I really, given the criticisms that are raised on the panel, I'd like an opportunity to respond, if I might.
Sure.
Could you pull up Strauss's slides, please? Go to his second slide that he had up. This is going to take a minute, or. The response is, so that was one of the charts, not one I showed you. I showed you with one with no periodization at all, so there's no grouping of how to group it. And then let's go to the next one of his. Oh, I should press the button. Sorry. Okay, so if you look over there on the right column where this one supposedly makes the effect go away, first of all, he does this on the basis of appointments. The problem isn't that people are staying too long on the day they're appointed. The problem is they're staying too long after they're appointed. You don't pick dates of appointments to assess this. Second, our thesis is that there's been an increase since 1970. Look at the last group there. It's 1961, I believe, if I can read it on. That includes Goldberg and Fortas. That you can't test a thesis that there's been a change since 1970 by including people who were appointed resigned after. Further, you can't really pick appointments since 1970 because there have been so few appointments that, you know, I went to college in the fall of 1970. I think since then there's only been three justices who've been appointed and have left the court since then, Rehnquist, Powell, and O'Connor. The comment about this wouldn't lengthen tenure is absolutely false. Every justice, with the exception of, by next summer, I think every justice, with the exception of Breyer and the last two appointments, would be beyond the what had been average tenure up through 1970. And as far as Stephen Burbank's comments, which were quite strongly worded, I guess I'd like to say that I found them just really quite incredible, because this idea that he's pointing to political science literature, if there's one thing that you see if you read his article, is a complete tone deafness about what's going on in these pieces. Not being an empiricist, he can't tell good work from bad work. He cites with approval work that says there's no trend in the relationships. We've done statistical analyses with dozens of models. Every single one finds a time trend in it. He cites as if it's plausible work by a political scientist. I've gotten data from some of the political scientists that he favors, rerun the numbers. One of the reasons that they tend not to find effects is because their models are incompetently fit. Most of them treat the death and retirement, leaving office for either reason, is what they're trying to model, the same outcome. But we show that there's two effects and there's cross-cutting. You tend to die when the president is of the opposing party. You tend to retire when the president is of your party. Those two effects cancel them out if you're only modeling whether someone leaves during a presidency for political reasons. And that's not the kind of thing, unless you understand statistics, you're likely to see. We got data and re-ran them on some of them. Some of them were so incompetently run by political scientists that they found no effect for pension. We found 8 times greater pension effect when we ran the numbers. Even when people are, there's one person who's contributed to the literature who's just an eminent statistician, and talking to one of his co-authors, she said, well, but that's not one of his best pieces. One of the things that he did was that he modeled how many justices leave in a particular year based on politics. Well, again, the Republicans might be more likely to leave during 1 year and the Democrats more likely to stay. You're gonna have cross-cutting effects. So also some of the things that he cites to, it does not mention when the evidence cuts against his position. He cites to a piece talking about trends under the either Berger or Rehnquist court in terms of following the public opinion, doesn't mention that it shows that the longer time you serve on the bench, farther away you get from public opinion, from modeling public opinion. I'll stop there. I understand.
Leave time for questions too.
That's fine. Sure. I'll stop there.
Okay. Thanks. One of the things I'm going to give you a chance to respond for sure, but I don't want this just to become a battle of empirical studies and my statistician versus his statistician and that kind of thing, because we can debate that for a long time.
Or the entire audience.
Yeah.
But what I do want to ask you, just on a practical level, Steve and Jim do seem to make a pretty persuasive case that there's a dramatic increase in length of tenure, and they talk about from 14.9 historically to 26.1 today. And if you realize, or if the argument has been made that Supreme Court justices are the closest thing we have to royalty, and that they live in a world that may be out of touch increasingly with either current trends or with the broader spectrum of society, that it's an insular lifestyle with they're in court and their bar meetings and their law school speeches and their courthouse dedications, but the argument is made that it's sheltered. And you get, if you increase it from 15 to 25 years, that increases the danger of a court that's out of touch and that has no regular democratic accountability. So it seems to me that's a pretty serious criticism of your position, and I'd like to hear what you say about it.
Well, I was in sympathy with a lot of the arguments that were made by the people who asked me to support their proposal. It wasn't Steve and Jim, it was Roger Crampton and Paul Carrington. Although I think I would frame the problem as I see it a little bit differently. I think, recall that Brandeis said that I can do good work in 11 months, but not in 12. I don't think most of the justices of the Supreme Court are even working close to 11 months now. And they're not cloistered. They're off in Europe lecturing. They've cut their, when I clerked for Warren Berger, the court was deciding 150 cases a year. Last year they decided, depending upon how you count, either 69 or 70 or 71. I don't think they're working very hard. I think they've become poobahs. I think that we have a serious problem in having only, sparing your presence, Judge, former Court of Appeals judges on the Supreme Court. I think we have a lack of variety of experience. Moreover, in terms of the concern that I just articulated, if some of them are acting like poobahs, and this would resonate with some of the things that Chuck was saying, It may be because for somebody who has been a judge before, being on the Supreme Court of the United States is the be-all and the end-all. That's not true for everybody. A young political scientist named Justin Crowe, with a co-author, wrote a wonderfully titled article, which is also a very interesting article, "Where Have You Gone, Sherman Minton? The Demise of the Short-Term Justice." We don't have short-term justices anymore, but when we did, you would find that most of them came from other careers, and they didn't necessarily regard being on the Supreme Court as the capstone of their life. Obviously, it's a tremendously important position. But one of the reasons that people don't want to retire nowadays, I take it, is precisely because, gosh, this is, you know, I was a judge, and I've been a judge for a long time. This is what I want to do. I'd like to see more politicians. I'd like to see a lot more different sorts of experience on the Supreme Court, and that would address some of the problems. But I do not agree that the fundamental weakness of the proposals here is possible strategic behavior. I think that's a weakness. I think the fundamental weakness is that the case has not been made for changing a very important part of our Constitution, recognizing how difficult it is to change the Constitution and the risks that we run. I just don't think that the case has been made for it, certainly not in terms of democratic accountability and the problems of democratic accountability. So I guess, you know, I think there are some problems, but I just don't think the case has been made for fundamental constitutional change.
The one thing I would add to Steve's remarks as well is that, you know, while they're not perfectly at odds, democratic accountability and slow legal change are at odds, right? If you want democratic accountability, basically what you're saying is the justices need to be sympathetic, or they need to be more cognizant of the particular political arguments of the time. We shouldn't have people who reflect the viewpoints that are 30 years in the past. Well, what that means oftentimes is that you're going to have courts changing their minds. And in fact, in a study that was done of state courts, Jeffrey Renz, I think, did it, where he looked at Rhode Island and New Hampshire, Rhode Island has pure life tenure, New Hampshire is pretty close. They reversed themselves only, I think, 6 or 8 times over a 10-year period, and those were the two lowest states in the study, as opposed to elections and various other methods, where you had as many as 109 overrulings in Montana during that same period. And so I think what you see is, yes, you may have a little greater democratic accountability, but you have it very much at the cost of stability and legitimacy. So one thing I would throw out is, you know, a court that is viewed as wholly political would not have legitimacy, for example, for the American public to accept a case like Bush versus Gore, or to accept a case like Brown versus Board of Education, both of which were, you know, not well accepted by a large segment of the society at the time they were decided. And so I think that legitimacy is a very important part of life tenure. It may be a result, and they may not have even foreseen it. The founders, the framers may not have foreseen it, but I think that's very important. So what I want to stress is there is definitely a tension between democratic accountability and stability.
I want to turn it over to questions after just one final comment, and that is the case against life tenure seems to be built on mental decline and decrepitude. And I'm not sure that premise is altogether correct. Might it not be that people actually become more reflective, more seasoned, and even more creative in their old age? Law is a profession that rewards seasoned judgment. It's a little bit different from mathematics and music and physics, which tend to reward prodigies. And if you look, for example, in fields outside of law, very senior people have done very marvelous things. Milton wrote Paradise Lost at a very advanced age. Monet painted the cathedrals and the water lilies at a very advanced age. Chaucer wrote the Canterbury Tales at a relatively advanced age for his time. And Oliver Wendell Holmes served productively in his 80s, and some would make the argument that Justice Hugo Black's opinions in the later phases of his career were far richer and more powerful than some of the opinions earlier in his career. And people would make the argument that justices get better with time in many instances, rather than declining. I know Justice Powell felt that way, that he became better as the years went on. And if we have 18-year terms, are we not sacrificing the advantages that come with reflection, seasoned judgment, experience, and a whole lot of other things that actually may make very senior justices very creative and powerful forces on the court? Do we really want to go without that? Isn't that what you're proposing, Chuck?
Judge, I appreciate you turning to me because in your initial question, you associated me with the defense of the Lindgren Calabresi 18-year proposal, which I do not favor. I think that many of the predictive judgments that my friend Steve Burbank has articulated against it, I tend to be persuaded by. I do think it would eliminate the problem of strategic retirements, but I think that's a very marginal problem, frankly. It clearly doesn't go to the heart of what I think the problem of life tenure and complete independence and lack of judicial accountability. And I think even eliminating that problem would likely beget the concern that I haven't heard raised here, which is strategic Senate behavior. I think the Senate could frustrate this by simply refusing to confirm a presidential nomination until another presidential election. But, you know, my bottom line here is that life tenure has to be changed, and I welcome Steve's and Jim's and applaud their work on this and bringing forward in a very sharp way some of the problems, but I don't think that mental decrepitude, I agree with much of what you have just said, and think that the problem of mental decrepitude is not sufficient reason to amend our Constitution. I think sufficient reason are the reasons offered by those who were concerned about life tenure in the first place. And in fact, those who favored life tenure were concerned about that too. They didn't welcome activist willful judges. They just thought impeachment would be enough, and that clearly hasn't.
And yet any proposal to modify life tenure would have to be on neutral principles, and you might find yourself having a lot of restrained judges removed under these principles and a lot of very activist judges put in, and you would worsen the condition you decry, wouldn't you?
No, I don't think so, because, again, this isn't my proposal. I favor some different proposals. I even prefer Jefferson's proposal to this, which is five to six year renewable terms when a justice body of work could be brought forward and examined in a new appointment process, one that the people were allowed to obviously attempt to influence. But the proposal I favor, Judge, and this will perhaps even shock Steve, is one that combines Jefferson's proposal with the experiment in that great laboratory out there in among the states that California has. You will probably recall that a few years ago, Justice Rose Byrd and two of her colleagues.
Your age, John, 22 years ago.
Has it been 22? It's a long damn time ago. But Justice Rose Byrd and two of her colleagues reversed 61 out of 61 death penalties. Now, the people of California, in their core, understood that something other than the rule of law was being applied there, and they exercised the power they had reserved to themselves to throw off tyrants with a retention election. I would like serious consideration given to a six-year staggered renewable term for Supreme Court justices, renewable on the condition of an affirmative vote of the people. I'd like that considered. Because even though that would, I think, more or less give over the proposition that the Supreme Court is a political institution, I think that's the reality we face. And I also think that the people, in their basic
gut understand what the rule of law is, even though that eludes the vast bulk of legal academics. They understand that. And so I don't fear the judgment of the people when justice's body of work is brought forward for their judgment. That's what I'd like to see considered.
Well, but Chuck, some of the great decisions of the Supreme Court have been those that the people roundly disapproved of at the time.
That's true. And some of them they quite properly roundly disapproved of and should have visited the consequences of those decisions upon the Rose Byrds.
All right, we need to hear from Steve Calabresi because he has been standing patiently at the microphone and he is one of the co-authors of this very interesting study. So Steve, give us your thoughts and ask a question.
Thank you, Judge. I actually have two questions, one for Steve and one for David. My question for Steve is, you call for more empiricism and for looking at what actually works. And I wonder how you would respond to the argument that we make that life tenure is an institution which no other court seems to use. No other modern Western democracy has life tenure for its highest court judges, not England, not France, not Germany, not Canada, not Japan, not South Africa, not Australia. And 49 out of 50 states have rejected life tenure. And so I guess the question is, if this is such a good thing, why are the federal courts the only place in the world essentially where it's used, particularly since we know the reasons life tenure were favored by the framers were primarily because they wanted to make sure that 17th century English history, where kings fired judges who were deciding cases lawfully, wouldn't repeat itself, and we don't face that problem today. We face different problems instead, and every modern democracy that has addressed those problems has thought the way to solve it is with a constitutional court with fixed terms. My question for David is, don't all the arguments you make against term limits for Supreme Court justices also suggest that we shouldn't have a two-term limit for the president? You could say, you know, if you have a two-term limit for the president, there'll be terrible final period problems in the second term. We made a judgment as a people that the danger of abuse of power and lack of accountability and of someone being perpetually reelected was sufficient to outweigh those problems. What Jim and I are arguing here is simply that because the average tenure on the court has gone from 15 years to more than 26 years, which is a huge increase, due in part to the fact, as Steve pointed out, that the justices lead a very coddled existence, that has become a serious issue and has made the court less accountable than it used to be. And so just as we needed a two-term limit on the president to restore the tradition that presidents would leave after 8 years, maybe we need term limits now.
Steve? Thank you. Well, one of the problems of taking a minute to discuss the world is that you may not have heard what I had to say on it, but I did actually mention my views on that, and I do in the article. My response, Steve, relates to the concern that you and Jim and Roger and Paul and others who've been advocating this take a view of judicial independence that I call both dichotomous and monolithic. That is to say, you treat independence as completely separate from accountability when they are joined at the hip, and you treat judicial independence, dichotomously treated, as if it were the same in all parts of the world, in every polity in the United States and internationally. It seems to me not a good way of proceeding. If you look at an 18-year term, and particularly if you understand that the median or mean length of service for justices over time has been a little bit short of 18 years, from the point of view of judicial independence, it looks pretty good. But what I want to know is what is the quantum of judicial accountability that a particular system will bring about. And without knowing about the legal system of France or Germany or the United Kingdom, and knowing a lot about it, not just superficially, I don't know whether the fact that they have chosen not to go with life tenure tells me what I need to know in order to predict what a Supreme Court would look like under your proposal, which is why I spent so much of the time in my article devoted to trying to figure out what the quantum of judicial accountability would be in a system where, once it was fully operational, you'd have two appointments in every four-year term. and my study of the legitimacy literature in political science and the literature on interest groups persuaded me that the quantum of accountability that you would get would be unacceptable for the United States because it would, as I say, confirm the worst tendencies of modern politics, which is to persuade the people, and there are a lot of people who want to do this, to persuade people that courts are part of ordinary politics, that judges are merely policy agents of a president, if you're talking about a federal judge, or of the people, if you're talking about a state judge. And I don't think that that's what we should want from our Supreme Court. So it to me, it's almost irrelevant that other nation states have chosen not to have a life tenure. Moreover, and finally, Ward Farnsworth has pointed out, at least with respect to the European experience, that it may be quite a different thing to when you are constructing a judiciary in 1930 or 1980, or for the new post-Soviet countries after 1990, to say we're not going to have life tenure. One thing to do that, and another thing to change a constitution that has worked tolerably well for more than 200 years.
I want to get David into this. So, Steve, you had a question for David.
I'll go ahead and address that. We do have a little bit of a disagreement with the 26.1 years, but I don't want to touch that. If you want to read more about the empirical stuff, you certainly can refer to Jim and Steve's article, but you can also refer to a paper I co-authored with Ryan Scott, a former student of mine, which is in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy. So I'll leave that alone for now. But your question is a difficult one, and I probably think that no matter what answer I give you, you're probably not going to be satisfied, given that you know so much about the presidency, and I am by no means an executive power scholar. But the short answer is that the presidency and the legislature, they're political branches, and fundamentally the judiciary is not. The judiciary is constrained, at least arguably, although political scientists have disputed this, they're constrained by stare decisis. And sure, there's custom and there's culture in the political branches, and there's prior opinions of prior presidents, but they're not constrained in the same way that judges are. And so my argument would be these are fundamentally different branches. And furthermore, if you go back into the Federalist Papers and early American history, it is highly suggestive of the fact that the judiciary is meant to be an anti-majoritarian institution, particularly the Supreme Court. I don't think anyone can make an argument that the presidency, which is elected every 4 years, or the House, which is elected every 2 years, or the Senate every 6 years, is meant to be anti-majoritarian. In fact, it's quite the opposite. They're meant to be majoritarian. And so while you're absolutely right that some of those arguments would transfer to the presidency, I just think they're fundamentally different institutions and have different roles in the government.
Lino, let's hear your question.
I think that, unfortunately, proposals to limiting tenure are a very indirect way and almost surely an inadequate way of addressing the problem. The problem is, as Chuck said, the judges are running the country. The judges are making the policies. We are in a situation at the moment where whether or not Louisiana can have capital punishment rape depends on how Kennedy votes that day. Whether or not there's habeas corpus for alleged terrorists, whether or not there's a right to own a gun, whether or not you can take race into account in a science, all of these things depend on how Kennedy votes. Clearly the most powerful man in the country. Now that's the problem. Right, I mean, we're following the Constitution and so on. You know, so much of this is so unrealistic. That is, in fact, I agree with Jefferson, first of all, unlike Strauss, that the Constitution is not holy scripture. There's a lot there that could be very much improved. But far more important, it's got nothing to do with constitutional law. That's our problem. The problem is the judges have assumed the ability to take any decision they wish, any public issue they wish, out of the public process and assign it to themselves. Now that's what you have to deal with. None of this is going to change. If the judges can only serve for 18 years, that's not going to change this situation. In fact, they may feel that you have to expedite their making the public policy decisions.
Well, doesn't Lino make a really good point, Chuck and Jim? Because you all are talking about changing the system with either Jeffersonian ideas or plebiscites or renewable terms or 18-year terms. And you think that changing the system is going to cure the problem? Lino's question suggests it's not. The problem is you got to win the war of ideas, not monkey around with the system. You've got to convince the American public that judging is something of restraint, that the rule of law matters, that personal policy preferences are illegitimate, and you're going at it by circumlocution and indirectly by tampering with the system, and when we ought to be outwinning the war of ideas about what judging is all about.
Well, you know,
I don't have to convince the public of that. The public understands that. It's the justices that we haven't convinced of that. It's their champions on the legal faculties.
What could be
that, and on the editorial pages. And in the fashionable salons right here in Washington, D.C., that we haven't convinced of that. The people understand that. They understand that in the basic core of their being. So that idea is one. That's why I wouldn't mind at all submitting that judgment to the people on a regular basis. My answer to Lino is, well done, my friend.
Well, you know, nothing could be more misleading than say the Constitution was meant to be anti-majoritarian. So it's good that we don't have democracy. We have an improvement here. Let the people vote, but let the Supreme Court make the final decision, right? Exactly the function performed by the Ayatollah in Iran is performed here. Now, the only way to fix this is we have to repeal the 14th Amendment. Or at least, well, this is the, without that, we wouldn't have constitutional law to speak of. And the Supreme Court has made that something what they can do, decide any issue they choose. Or make the 14th Amendment mean what it was supposed to mean, basic civil rights for blacks. Or enhance it to no race discrimination. Or make it mean anything specific. The problem is there's no specific now.
All right, Lino, Steve has asked for 1 minute. He's going to get a minute. And Jim has asked for a minute, and he's going to get his minute.
I simply wanted to point out that in an unsigned editorial in the New Republic in either 1924 or 1925, Felix Frankfurter, as he then was, advocated repeal of the 14th Amendment because of the activist judges who happened then to be conservatives who were using it to strike down state legislation.
And it's the only sensible approach to this problem. That's true.
I just wanted to point out it's not a new idea, and you're in good company.
All right, Jim, you make a comment, and then we're going to go to David.
Okay. Our proposal is designed simply to return to prior levels of these problems. We're not trying to cure all of this problem. What we're trying to do is to remove the incremental effect of having these lengthening tenures on this. And one of the articles that Stephen Burbank cites but doesn't describe the findings of actually says that not only do justices become farther away from public opinion as they are on the bench, but they become more liberal. So for those who are concerned about that, reducing judicial tenure would have that salient positive effect. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
All right. David, you said you wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, you know, I have faith in our activist judiciary in that if we repealed the 14th Amendment, I'm quite sure they would find some other penumbra of rights that would do everything the 14th Amendment would do. So the privileges and immunities clause in particular. So I don't think that would solve the problem, just like I don't think the Calabresi and Lindgren solves the problem. But I do take your point. The one thing I would add is I'm familiar with that study that you talked about. It's Lee Epstein and et cetera. And I think it shows, is that the one you're, okay, then I'll stop there. Great.
All right, next question.
This is going to be a question for Professor Lindgren. But I'd like to preface it by pointing out something which I think is very important, which is that obviously when we're looking at the data about the Supreme Court justices, we're not looking at a sample of some larger population of millions of Supreme Court justices. We're looking at actually every Supreme Court justice who has in fact served. And so if we group the data either, you know, smoothed over time or in 30-year blocks, we're not looking at something which is representative of a larger group, but rather what every actual justice in fact ended up doing. And now I read the Lindgren-Calabresi article with great interest, but one of the things that struck me, and this is what my question is about, is why you chose to fixate so much on the date of 1970. And for comparison, I would like to point out, so you've made this statement about what's happened in the last 38 years. And I believe, and I don't have the numbers handy.
All right, let's get to your question.
I'm getting there quickly. If I were to try to make this argument in 1849, I could look over the last 38 years of the period since 1811 or 1810, pick whichever one you want, and make basically all of the same claims, right? I could say, in the last 38 years, the justices have started serving an average length of 25 years on the court, and it's so much longer than it was in the time prior. And
so you're making the argument that the time periods are arbitrary?
No, I'm asking, you know, if I wanted to explain that, I could point out that what happened in 1810 was that Marshall had been on the court for a while and had been able to group power.
All right, I'm going to ask Jim to respond because we want questions here.
Very briefly.
What does 1970 mean?
Well, 1970, there's two ways to look at it. Does the pattern seem to shift in 1970? Yes, but that somewhat overstates the abruptness of it because we had justices like Douglas who'd been on the court for a long period of time, who had to make decisions in the 1950s and 60s to stay on the court. So one of our charts actually does it based on the every year of the court when that justice would eventually retire. So that smooths out that particular issue. As far as the 1840s, if you looked at in 1840s, in 1837 they added two justices. So it took a while to work out the positive effect of that reform.
If I can
we're going to get some other people involved in because it's the only fair that everybody gets to ask their question. Come forward, sir, and ask your question.
I am Ralph Cote from New York. My question is for Charles Cooper and for James Lindgren, and it basically is that most of your arguments for the 18-year tenure for Supreme Court would likewise seem to apply for the Court of Appeals. And if you wish to amend the Constitution, would it not also be worthwhile to have the same amendment apply to the Court of Appeals as well?
Not on this panel, it wouldn't, no.
We don't propose it for a number of reasons. One is that there doesn't seem to be a longevity problem on the Court of Appeals. And second, we have unfilled slots in the Court of Appeals, so we don't have the same problem.
I knew you guys were going to say something I agreed with. All right, next question.
I'm John from Ohio State, and this is for Professor Lindgren and Mr. Cooper. Your position is very interesting to me, but I don't see how it solves the problem that you started out with saying is judicial activism. It seems to me it would increase that because they know their time is shorter and they want to get more done. And doesn't it also kind of endorse the evolving standards thinking? Because if they're going to be subject to what the majority wants them to do, then it seems to me the Bill of Rights is just going to be written off because they are a bulwark against what the majority wants to do. And if the court can no longer legitimately say, Congress, you cannot ban free speech, but the majority wants to, it seems to me that their function is just done and they can't do what they really have a constitutional obligation to do.
I credit your point, especially with respect to concern, which I share, about an 18-year effective lease on the federal government that this proposal would provide. My concern is that it doesn't address the question of willful activism. I also think you make a very fair objection, which would require very deep consideration. I can't pretend that I've put the kind of thought into this that my colleagues in academia have here, but a very fair concern about the problem of which I'm suggesting consideration of genuinely allowing the people to make a judgment about the body of work of justices every 2 years, particular justices. But I think that's a dramatic idea. But I am very attracted to how it appears to work, at least in California, where it's not exercised frequently at all, perhaps not frequently enough. I think the California Supreme Court has given the people of that state another occasion to seriously consider. their the power they have reserved to themselves to throw off tyrants wherever they may be. But it does go against, and it leaves open the possibility that the people could effectively throw off a judge for genuinely doing his job. I think I'd be willing to run that risk, I think.
Thank you. Next question.
Michael O'Connor from the Penn Chapter of the Federalist Society. A question for Professor Lindgren. Just a brief clarification of one of your slides. As I read one of your slides, it said that there was 168% increase in the likelihood of retirement when the president is both of the same party and it was in the first 2 years of the presidency. I was wondering about the confounding effect of the two-year, your examination of the time within the presidency and what the statistic is with regards specifically to parties.
The effects for death in office apply both when you just look at by party and when it's concentrated in the last 2 years. The effect for retirement is significant if you use statistics, but for reasons suggested that this is an actual description of what justices do, is significant when it's concentrated in the first 2 years. The effect is there, but it's not doesn't meet significance levels for overall for just party alone. If I think that's the answer to your question.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
And next question.
Lester O'Shea, San Francisco. I want to address the question to those who are concerned about the willful activism. Considering the practical realities of actually changing the Constitution, wouldn't it be more practical to zero in on the culprits and recognize willful activism, in extreme cases at least, as lacking, as failing of good behavior, and impeach the judges? We impeached the justice, Judge Hastings in Florida. Isn't that the answer, to focus on the guilty parties instead of trying to get the Constitution changed so drastically?
I despair that that is the solution. I think it was actually unfortunate that Chase was not convicted in the Senate. I think it was unfortunate. I disagree with my mentor and former boss, Chief Justice Rehnquist, on that. But Hastings was impeached only for the only reason that judges have ever been impeached in this country. He was behind bars. Okay, but he shouldn't have been acquitted, and everybody else has actually been behind bars, holding on to their commission. So the Senate had no.
But I think the point that Mr. Cooper is making is that because of the failure of the Senate to remove Justice Chase in 1805, a constitutional custom or norm against initiating impeachment proceedings on the basis of the content of decisions is a very strongly entrenched norm. Norms can change, but it would be extremely difficult, I think, and probably very dangerous, certainly on the basis of one or two decisions. Rose Byrd, I don't bleed for Rose Byrd, but it should be pointed out that she took with her some of her colleagues who had not evinced the same extreme behavior. She did not vote. She could not find it in her to vote to affirm a capital conviction in 65 cases, notwithstanding the fact that both the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of California permitted the death penalty. That was not true of the two colleagues that that she took down with her. So that's a potential cost of the system of retention elections. As Penny White, who was non-retained in Tennessee, said, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. At least if you run against somebody, you know who your opponent is. In a retention election, you don't necessarily know who your opponent is.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Steve Klein from the Ave Maria chapter. I just have a quick question for Professor Lindgren. Under the 18-year term, how would you address the position of Chief Justice? Would there be an 18-year Chief Justice? Would everyone get a crack at it 2 years or neither, and why?
The proposal is that there be a slot, that the slot of Chief Justice could be someone who is elevated, could be someone appointed for 18 years to that slot, or could be someone who's appointed from the from an existing slot, but they would not get an additional time. So essentially, you could serve all or part of your 18 years as Chief Justice. As far as why, I'm not sure that I understand why. It's essentially the same reasons we have Chief Justices now. There's no particular reason one way or the other to change that.
Roger?
Yes, thank you, Jay. In listening to the debate, it strikes me that both sides are trying to guard against a set of errors, and you've got a classic situation of your type 1, type 2 errors and how to best guard against them. And it seems to me that, and I invite your comment on this, that what Steve and Jim have proposed is just another measure to sort of take the human element out of it. After all, the Constitution is a measure to take some of the human element out of government. Term limits for president is an effort to do that. Seems to me term limits for justices would do that too. It would give us a kind of mechanical process because nobody knows which one of the errors. We can't sit here today and say, is it better to guard against decrepitude, or is it better to guard against the kind of thing that Jay raised of people removed from the bench who should be allowed there because they're so qualified? None of us can determine that, and it seems to me a mechanical process would allow us to guard against, or at least give us a way to address the type 1, type 2 problem that is what really you're debating here today.
Do some of you have a comment on Roger's point?
I could certainly talk about that. I agree with you that there are problems on both sides. I guess my reaction is I just don't find the overall case convincing. In fact, I find it very unconvincing. And as somebody who studies the Constitution and teaches constitutional law, you know, I see the Constitution as a cohesive whole, and certainly you make amendments to that. But usually you have a pretty strong reason to do so. And here I just don't think that the burden has been met. And I think there's some other things that we didn't get a chance to talk about. One thing I would point out is I think confirmation battles would probably become more contentious. I know that Steve and Jim disagree with that, but I think that what would happen is if you know each president is going to have two appointments and say Justice O'Connor's or Justice Kennedy's seat were at issue, I think people would gear up for that battle two or four years in advance, knowing that the entire court hangs in the balance. Now we have a justice retire. There's a flurry of activity. 3 weeks later, you know, we're already commencing confirmation hearings. And so I actually think, it certainly depends. I mean, but things move relatively quickly. There are certainly exceptions. I know my boss's confirmation hearing took quite a while. My former boss's, but. But I do think that I do think that you're right, but I would fall on the Burkean side. I would say let's make incremental moves, and that's why, you know, there's things like pension reform that Jim concedes has been very effective in the past. So maybe we need to do more with pension reform. Maybe we need to make the office of senior justice or retired justice much more attractive so that they don't feel like they're going to be ostracized from their colleagues and that their only judicial experience is going to go to sit on the circuit. And so I think that there's ways we can encourage justices to retire or to resign without looking for a constitutional change.
But will all of those things even put together really persuade someone to give up the influence that comes with being a Supreme Court justice, David?
Yeah, and that's a question that's hard to answer. I mean, the empirical data would suggest that the answer is probably yes, but we don't know for sure because all we have is data on the pension, on what judges do once they reach pension eligibility.
I'm not so sure even about that. Yeah. If you're a senior judge on the courts of appeals, and one of the answers to the problem, why not do this for the Court of Appeals, is the data show that 80% of courts of appeals judges take senior status within 1 year of their eligibility to do so. But presumably one of the reasons they do is that, and this depends upon the court, and there could be better empirical work done looking at these factors because the courts of appeals have different rules about what senior judges are allowed to do. But one thing they surely are allowed to do everywhere is sit on cases, and to the extent that that's what gives a judge satisfaction, as your question, Judge, suggests, then courts of appeals judges get to do that. Moreover, they get to a great extent to pick and choose which cases they sit on, which is also, if you don't like criminal cases, you don't have to sit on criminal cases. They get to visit other parts of the country. So I think the two situations are very, very different.
One thing that I threw around when I was writing my initial paper but didn't decide on ultimately was what would happen if you allow senior Supreme Court justices justices sit on cases when one or more of the active justices are recused. And I thought that that might go a long way towards incentivizing justices to retire because they would still
and
have
also
that power
recuse.
And influence. Yeah. So, but I throw that out.
I have been. Can we make one real quick comment? Because I've been given really strict instructions by my bosses at the Federalist Society to end this on time.
I just want to say that on pension reform is one area in which we're in agreement. I think the problem is that the golden parachute would have to be awfully golden because in the past, all we had to do was make the pensions available, which are at full pay, including increases in salary. We've got to do much more. And if we're worried that there's some possibility that even after many years on the bench, someone might go into private practice of some kind, we might want to offset any further earnings if we make a very golden parachute.
I want to thank the members of the audience for coming today and for being so engaged. And I can't tell my fellow panelists how much I've enjoyed them and what great ideas and what a stimulating debate we've had. So thanks for a wonderful start to the morning, everybody.